This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities. Protecting worker rights, and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, it's Second Monday Labor Radio with us, Megan and Meredith. Last month, we brought stories of workers in Seattle who took part in the one-day strike to call for $15 an hour, among other demands, for low-wage food service workers.
Tonight, we'll continue this theme with an interview with local workers trying to form a union at the zoo.
And we'll speak to two members of the Industrial Workers of the World about the larger context of capitalism and how low-wage service work has rapidly expanded since the 1970s.
But first, in labor news, BART transit workers in the San Francisco Bay Area were on strike all last week over raises and working conditions. They've returned to contract negotiations for a month, but managed to shut down the financial centers on Monday, July 1st, when Oakland City workers joined them for a one-day strike over unfair labor practices.
And locally, since Monday, July 1st, 725 workers at Daimler's Swan Island truck plant have been out on strike. Members of International Association of Machinists, Local 1005, and International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, Local 1094, have increased productivity 25%, but have not received the wage increases to keep up with that extra work. They also want their raises without having to pick up additional medical costs, which would in fact not really be a raise. The union says community support for this crucial struggle is hugely appreciated. If you can help out on the picket line from 6 a.m., 7 days a week, or can bring refreshments, you can go to the boat ramp on North Basin Avenue and Emerson on Swan Island for instructions.
Five activists named the Postal Protectors were arrested at the Matheson Flight Extenders facility July 3rd, demanding that Matheson drop negotiations for subcontracting, mail handling, and mail processing. They were successful in disrupting the Matheson operation for a couple of hours, shaking up the privatizers, and inspiring postal workers and allies nationwide. They are highlighting the fact that as good union post office jobs are slashed, private contractors swoop in to make high profits, all part of a neoliberal attack on public services that's been going on for 40 years.
Now, our focus on low-wage workers last month mainly included service workers at fast food chains, but there are low-wage workers in every sector. It might surprise some people to learn that the largest employer of low-wage workers is the federal government, which gets away with it through subcontracting out services. Local city and county governments are in on it too, looking to cut labor costs. The Portland Mercury reported last week that the city council's recent victory on paid sick days will not apply to the 500 to 700 temporary employees working for Oregon Metro Food Service. Workers at the Oregon Zoo say that's one of the reasons they have decided to organize a union. Workers say it's about fairness and making the zoo a better place to work. I spoke to two food workers at the zoo about their experiences and reasons for organizing a union in their workplace.
My name's Olivia, and I work as a catering staff member at the Oregon Zoo.
Great, and how long have you worked there?
I actually just had my 1 year anniversary as a seasonal temp.
So, yeah. So is that, if you want to talk a little bit about why you are in a union fight right now?
Well, I didn't really want to join a union, to be honest, but after I went to the meeting and spoke with Toby and some of my other coworkers and saw how things were from the other side of things, from like the food side and from the kitchen side, then I really, I became passionate about it because I saw how poorly we were being treated. There's still a lot of things that need to change in order for everyone to be really happy. So I want to be a part of that movement to make that change.
I'm interested in how some of your ideas changed. Was there any particular moment or idea where you started to realize, you know what your life could be like and how it could be different?
Well, I think the moment where I really like reached that decision was when I went to a meeting about starting up the union. It was actually the meeting where we decided to turn in the petition, because I initially thought that it was just for like the, we call them foodies, but the people who do like the elephant ears and work the stands in the restaurants and everything that the public sees on a regular. And so I was like, you know, I don't know about them, so why would I fight for them? But then I heard about them and their plight and how it actually relates to what we're receiving as well, because nobody gets tips. And that's a really big thing here in catering, since we do charge for gratuity and we don't see it. I felt like that was the connection right there, that they can't get tipped, we don't get tipped. That's a really big thing, so let me go ahead and hear more.
Wait, what do you mean by they charge for gratuity but you don't see it?
Oh, yeah. At every catered event that we do, they charge gratuity. So, like, from one of the more recent ones, the zoo charged 18% for gratuity, and the client paid it, thinking that it was going to go to the staff so that nobody has to offer tips. But we don't get tipped as public workers. So I don't know where that goes. We don't see it.
My name is Randy Schiller, and I work for Metro at the Oregon Zoo.
And what do you do there?
I work in the catering department. I was working in food services as well before I ran out of hours.
Well, what's the main reason why you want to join a union?
Food services in general, I think, is feeling kind of left out in the cold as far as new employees. We're one of like the few departments that is not represented by a union. As per Metro and the zoo's employment, we're considered temporary employees, so we do not get any benefits.
And you personally, what would being in the union and having those kinds of benefits do for you? How would it benefit you?
One of our proposals is having paid sick leave. That would be a huge deal, because I had an illness this year where I had to miss 2 days of work, and my paycheck suffered greatly because of it. And that sort of thing just encourages employees to come to work sick when you absolutely should not, when you're handling food.
People keep saying the word temp workers. Is there something temporary about the work you do?
Oh, absolutely not. I've worked here for over a year now, and I have coworkers that have worked here for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and they are still considered temps.
And that was Olivia and Randy, food service workers at the Oregon Zoo, currently organizing a union with laborers Local 483.
To follow more about this campaign, check out zoolidarity.org.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, and you're listening to Labor Radio.
Megan interviewed two local members of the Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, about their participation and thoughts on the recent low-wage worker struggles.
So let's talk a little bit about what it takes for workers to come to this kind of realization that they need to take what is a pretty bold action that could have risks for them. What did you see helping as some of the factors that help these workers overcome fear of reprisals or?
Well, in my experience was that none of the workers that I talked to didn't think there was a problem before they were approached by an organizer with the campaign. All of them felt that their lives were not what they wanted to be. All of them felt that there was a problem, that they were struggling just to get by. And so I don't think we have to think of this as somehow they were convinced to take action. They were sort of given an opportunity. One of the things that's most exciting about this is there is a kind of spontaneous energy here where, you know, what we're seeing as opposed to some other more traditional union organizing drives that might take months or years to build a committee that can actually take aggressive action. The folks in these industries really are fed up, you know, and they really are ready to hit the streets. And, you know, they're not fools, right? So they need a plan that actually sounds good and makes sense, and they need an organization that they can trust. But it's not a giant leap for them to want to change their life. They just have never seen an opportunity that makes sense to them to do that. I mean, these are industries that have never been touched by organized labor. I mean, there were attempts in the 70s by Acorn and other groups to form unions in these kind of groups in these kinds of industries, but nothing has ever really taken off, and nothing has galvanized the public attention in the ways that these things have.
The Wobblies, at least locally, but I believe nationwide, have been organizing in this industry, in restaurant work, that tends to be more atomized, that tends to be more dispersed. So what is the strategy here? How does one build an organization across multi-employers that span the country?
Well, I think there are certain models that the IWW has established within the Starbucks Workers Union for the past almost 10 years, which immediately when they started realized that the election process was going to be extremely geared into the favor of the employer and moved their campaign strategy to focusing on shop floor demands and shop floor power regarding scheduling, enforcement of wages, just respect on the workplace, respect from customers, and the ability to actually have voice on the job. And I think picking up after that, the Jimmy John's Workers Union, which picked up in Minneapolis in 2010, was an election effort, but they were also demanding things that are beyond just wages and benefits. I feel like with significant components of that were their demands for opening up the books and seeing how profitable the franchise was and where wages could be increased, as well as having collective meetings of workers with management regularly to address workplace issues. I think beyond that, the model is looking for a way where we can actually have collective management in our workplace too, in those businesses where we don't have, where we are empowering workers who often already know their job and how to do things. Beyond just having higher wages and the right to organize, the next step for us is also just having control of our work. And also, beyond that, having control within the food industry so that we can be serving food that is healthy and we can be making those decisions that the food is safe and be empowered to make sure that the work that we're doing is serving safe food and not being pressured by timelines and bosses to put out unsafe food.
This reminds me, this touches on another issue that is having success across the country, the fight for paid sick days, and which is especially relevant for restaurant workers who are serving food to people. Do you see these as kind of related trends?
Yes, I think it certainly does. I think what we're seeing with paid sick days, the campaigns around the country, is also connected to just a value of the work. I think culturally, the work of fast food workers has always been kind of degraded. And honestly, I think what I see coming from the paid sick days campaigns and from this Fight for 15 movements is a real change in workers demanding respect because they are the ones that are feeding you. They're putting food in your stomach. They're taking their time, energy, and to make food for you to live on for you and your families. And that deserves our respect. It's a service that's in demand by the public, and thus we should have the right to organize and have safe conditions and be able to live in prosperity from doing so.
I think there's also this question of food and this question of the service industry. We're at a very unique historical moment here where this industry has been growing. The fast food industry has been growing over the last 40, 50 years, and it's been a largely low-wage, largely marginalized industry, and the workers there have been marginalized workers. One thought around this is that if we think about the structure of the family and the structure of the way that workers fed themselves and reproduced themselves day to day, before fast food, there were gender division of labor where you had the men would go home and make often union wages and be able to sustain their partner for to stay home and cook and reproduce themselves for the next day. As capitalism changed in the 70s, and as women entered the workforce and as wages got lower, that was no longer sustainable. And so fast food actually became this way to feed the working class, right? And not only that, it was a way for women to continue doing the reproductive labor they were doing in the household, but out in the workforce now. And so we see in the fast food industry, there's 2/3 is women workers in these workplaces, right? And so if we want to have a feminist workplace organizing strategy, the service industry is a really crucial place to be targeting.
That's interesting. So that brings me to something I kind of wanted to tease out, which is who are these fast food workers? Who is in the service industry today?
Well, I think the stereotype that I heard from people on the streets when I was talking to them about what was going on in Seattle is that, well, these are just kids that need to, you know, literally someone told me on the street in Seattle that they just had to pull up their bootstraps. Literally, I never thought someone would actually say that to me, but they did. And that's the stereotype that these are youth workers and that these conditions are fine for youth workers, which in itself is a problem. Because this is the jobs where most folks get their start in, and then those surveillance tactics that employers use, the low trust, and the degrading work conditions, the sexual harassment, the discrimination, the favoritism, thus become ingrained in young workers' minds, and they anticipate and maybe expect that's the way it is at their next job. Organized labor cannot ignore that if they want to continue moving on, if they're the new crop of workers are pretty much trained to expect those to be the conditions as is. But while a significant number of young workers are in the industry, you're also seeing a progressing number of older folks within the workplace as well, folks with families, and many folks working multiple jobs. I heard from many folks that since the recent change in or expected changes in healthcare, workers at these fast food locations have been cut down from full-time to part-time in order for the employer to avoid any responsibility of health insurance. So that battle is always been going on, part-time work within fast food, but we're seeing in a more aggressive nature by employers to force people into part-time hours, force people to work multiple jobs, and still not get employer-provided health care. And this is going to be an attack on all workers in the workplace. But yeah, I think it is a stereotype to assume that young workers work in fast food. I think if you look behind the kitchen door, if you actually examine, you know, these workplaces, you'll see a progressive number of older folks who have no other, as the industry, the job growth that we've seen in this country has always been in service industry and not within other sectors. So the demographic is becoming more diverse.
I was just going to add a couple points. One is that the median age of a fast food worker is 28 years old, right? And that's the median age, meaning 50% of the people who work in fast food are older than 28. One of the strikers that we were working with out there had worked at this Burger King for 7 years. And I asked him, are you the oldest person there? Are you the longest running worker there? And he said, no, actually, there are three people who have beat me at his Burger King. And so these are actually jobs that people are trying to make a living off of and trying to have a family off of. In addition to that, you know, when people think about, you know, oh, these are workers that sort of don't count, they think they're young workers, and they also, frankly, think they're workers of color and new immigrant workers who maybe don't speak English or don't have any historical roots in this country. And the idea that immigrant workers and workers of color are somehow structurally, you know, it's okay that these folks are stuck in low-wage jobs because maybe their children will work better jobs is really disgusting. And I think if people actually were to have a conversation with some of these workers who are driving for an hour and a half to work their minimum wage job at a Burger King just so that their kid might go to community college, would understand that this is not a sustainable reality and this is not a healthy economy.
There's another trend of high-profile strikes that we've seen across the country, the unfair labor practice strikes that Walmart workers have been taking. What is it about these one-day strikes and these non-traditional labor tactics, or what is this signaling to us about the next wave of approach to action that unions should be taking?
Well, I think a big part of the conversation around the recent fast food strikes and our Walmart is the ways that these efforts are relating to current U.S. labor law. It's not a surprise or a new thing for trade unionists in the U.S. to realize that American labor law is broken. Richard Trumka, the current president of the AFL-CIO, in the early 90s made a famous speech where he said that labor law is rigged for the bosses. If we play by the rules, we will always lose. That's been true for the last 40, 50 years in this country. And there's a great book by Joe Burns, which just came out a couple of years ago, called Arriving the Strike, where he really lays out the ways that labor law has handcuffed the American working class and handcuffed the American trade union movement to limit their ability to actually have effective tactics against employers. And so with our Walmart, what we see is UFCW, a very traditional union, one that has tried to make efforts in the past to do interesting things, but has come up against things like RICO suits, which are racketeering suits. And SEIU has also come against RICO suits, which our Walmart is an effort that's funded by UFCW but in a arm's length manner. that actually maintains a legal distance so that our Walmart can take on things without risking the parent union's asset. These projects with the fast food strikers do involve SEIU and SEIU resources, but they are not SEIU projects per se. And they're very careful to ensure that community groups, especially these ACORN groups, have a large leadership and large stake, and they actually form these coalitions in every city that are the center of the campaign to protect these other organizations. And really what that's saying to us is that we're coming to a moment where even traditional unions like the UFCW, like SEIU, are coming up against a wall of labor law and trying to experiment in ways that they can actually break labor law. They're very careful. They were very careful, always never to put undue risk on the workers, but they are leaving themselves room. There's another important precedent with this, which is the American Federation of Teachers had a document that came out, I think about 10 years ago, that articulated a strategy where unions create these no-asset organizations and loan resources and staff time to these organizations that can go off and do things that the parent organization would never be able to do. And, you know, I think we have to ask ourselves, A, what kind of strategies are going to work and actually succeed in creating more room for the working class to resist and more room to organize without retaliation, which is the demand in Seattle? But also, why is it in 2012 and 2013 that we're seeing these rumbling giants stirring awake and actually start to experiment with this? Because it's been true for 40 years, and we're just now coming to a moment where these experiments are happening.
Well, why is it? Any ideas?
I mean, I think that it's because the trade union movement is actually starting to get inspired again, which is really interesting. I think post-Wisconsin, you know, Occupy was one thing, and the trade union movement interacted with Occupy in a very complicated and often unproductive way. But Wisconsin, you hear these labor leaders talking about Wisconsin over and over again. And I think finally people are seeing some kind of glimmer of hope, and they're willing to put some resources behind new projects. I remember seeing John Nichols from Wisconsin speak once where he said, you know, again and again, we would go to rallies and ask ourselves, is it the 30s? And we would say no. But for once in Wisconsin, during the occupation of the Capitol, we said, is it the 30s? And the answer was kind of, you know. And you know, there's an important other parallel here, which is that we're also in a condition of the economy that's not so dissimilar from the 30s. And so, big surprise, the working class is rumbling again. And big surprise, the trade union movement is actually trying to figure out how to capture that energy. And actually, that's a concrete possibility.
And so for our listeners, I imagine there's one or two, there's a few, there's several, many restaurant workers, service industry workers who are listening tonight. Where could they go to find out more information? Where could they go to get involved?
I would recommend contacting the IWW. Myself, I'm a food service worker. I've been a service worker for all my life. And I got tired of seeing my coworkers, myself, be disrespected, facing conditions that I felt like I had no power over to change. And it was through that realization and meeting with the IWW that I was able to take on the skills and the tools to know how to challenge that behavior and make lasting changes in my workplace that both felt empowering and actually just improved my day-to-day life. So as the IWW, we don't focus on shop-by-shop organizing as much as maybe other unions. What we focus on is organizing workers to get workers the skills to challenge these behaviors in their workplace every day and build committees that can take action. So if you're interested in learning more about how we organize and how you yourself could become more of an agent of change in your own life and at your workplace, I would go to portlandiww.org. You can contact us there, and an organizer would be more than happy to meet with you, listen about what you'd like to see change in your workplace, and you can meet other folks within your industry that are doing the same thing.
And Dennis, can you tell folks where they could go to find out more information about this wave of fast food strikes?
Yeah, if you want to know more about each individual strike, there's been a lot of great articles at Salon.com and The Nation. The Seattle strike was organized by the groups Washington Community Action Network and When Working Washington, both of whom have great information on their websites.
So what do you guys think? Strike against poverty in Portland?
Why not? I mean, I feel like the conditions are not so dissimilar from Seattle or any other of the places that we've seen strikes. The industry is showing no signs of changing on its own. If anything is going to change, I feel like it's going to have to come from the workers organizing to make that happen. And I encourage folks to begin discussing this and start discussing it with organizations like the IWW.
Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks a lot.
This has been Second Monday Labor Radio. Be sure to check out past shows and additional content at KBOO.FM and tune in every Monday at 6 o'clock for Labor Radio. To play us out, the song stylings of Al Bradbury, former co-host of Second Monday Labor Radio and now a correspondent for Labor Notes in New York.
If the workers take a notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill. I was glued to Al Jazeera, weren't you, weren't you? As the people took down Ben Ali and then Mubarak too, and they took no compromise, they stood their ground. And in the end it was the strikes that brought it down. I guess what Joe Hill said was true, and in Egypt they know it too. If the workers take a notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations, will a tower come and stand still? Well, Wisconsin boldly over, how about you, how about you? How they took that building over, built the city in it too. Was shirted up in red, and the leaders followed when the people led. I guess what Joe Hill said was true, and in Wisconsin they know it too. If the workers take a notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations, will a tower come and stand still? I've been shivering in my boots. Well, haven't you? Haven't you? Since the earthquake hit Japan and all those safe reactors blew, and as the U.S. launches yet another war, sometimes I want to stay home and lock the door. But if what Joe Hill said was true, there's a lot we've got to do. If the workers take a notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations, will a tower come and stand still? If the workers take the notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations, will a tower come and stand still?
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and elevate the moral and social conditions of its members. Information at ubc156.org. The time is 6:28. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline up next.
Tune in Tuesday, July 9th at 9 a.m. for Alternative Radio. This week we'll hear from Michelle Alexander.
A great awakening is required. We have got to awaken from this colorblind slumber that we've been in to the realities of race in America. We've got to be willing to embrace those labeled criminals. Not necessarily all their behavior, but them, their humanness. For it has been the refusal and failure to recognize the dignity and humanity of all people that has been the sturdy foundation for every caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. It's our task, I firmly believe, to end not just mass incarceration, not just the war on drugs, but to end this history and cycle of caste in America. Thank you.
Alternative Radio airs Tuesday, July 9th at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Show me the prison. Show me the jail. Show me the prisoner whose life has gone stale. And I'll show you a young man with so many reasons. Sleeps out.